This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we have something special, an interview with Bruce Springsteen that I recorded last Friday at his home studio in New Jersey, not far from where he grew up. His new memoir shares the title of his most famous song, Born to Run. The theme of that anthem is escape, but in much of the book, Springsteen reflects on how he and his music were shaped by home, roots, blood, community, freedom, and responsibility. Throughout the book, you sense the presence of Springsteen's father, from whom Springsteen says he learned the rigidity and blue-collar narcissism of manhood 50s style, and the distorted idea that the beautiful things in your life, the love itself you struggle to win, will turn and possess you, robbing you of your imagined, long-fought-for freedoms. He says his father resented his own family for what he thought he might have accomplished, but didn't. Springsteen also has a new CD called Chapter and Verse that serves as an audio companion to the book with a selection of songs that span his career. Let's start with a track from the album that helps set the tone for our conversation. It's his demo recording of his song, Growing Up.
Okay, take two.
Well, I stood stone like at midnight, suspended in my masquerade. I combed my hair till it was just right and commanded the night brigade. I was open to pain and crossed by the rain, and I walked on a crooked crutch. Well, I strode all along to a fallout zone and came out with my soul untouched. I hid in the clouded wrath of the crowd. They said, sit down. I stood up. The flag of piracy flew from my mask.
Bruce Springsteen, welcome to Fresh Air, and thank you for welcoming us into your studio. I'd love it if you would start by reading the very opening from the foreword of your book. It's really a fantastic book, and I'd like our listeners to just hear a little bit of your writing.
Okay, my pleasure. I come from a boardwalk town where almost everything is tinged with a bit of fraud. So am I. By 20, no race car driving rebel. I was a guitar player on the streets of Asbury Park, and already a member in good standing amongst those who lie in service of the truth, artists with a small a. But I held four clean aces. I had youth, almost a decade of hardcore bar band experience, a good group of homegrown musicians who were attuned to my performance style, and a story to tell. This book is both a continuation of that story and a search into its origins. I've taken as my parameters the events in my life I believe shaped that story and my performance work. One of the questions I'm asked over and over again by fans on the street is, how do you do it? In the following pages, I'll try to shed a little light on how, and more importantly, why.
Thanks for reading that. So what's it like for you to write something that doesn't have to rhyme and that you don't have to perform on stage?
That's actually, not having to perform it on stage is a good one. But it's a little different, you know. I'm used to writing something. It becomes a record. It comes out. Then I go perform and I play it and I get this immediate feedback from the audience. So that's been the pattern of my life, but the book has been a little bit different, you know. You get feedback from the press, and the fans are just starting to get a chance to read it, so I'm looking forward to that. But you still had to find the music inside your language, you know. That's a big part of what sort of moved me to begin writing the book. I wrote a little essay, and I felt, yeah, this is a good voice. This is a good feeling, it feels like me. But then once you get into the book, you've got to constantly find the rhythm of your prose. And it ends up being quite a musical experience either way.
Well, that's one of the things I love about the book, is that there is rhythm and music in it, even though it's not a song. So we'll talk about this a little later, if it's okay with you, but in the book you write about how in your 60s, you've experienced periods of profound depression. And yeah. I'm wondering if that affected either the motivation for writing the book, your approach to writing the book, what you wanted to write about in the book.
No, it really didn't have anything to do with the book at all. The book was just something that came along after we played the Super Bowl, and I wrote a little essay that went online. Then I had 2 or 3 weeks, and I said, wow, that essay was pretty good. Maybe I'll try and write some other stuff. Writing about the Depression, I just felt, you know, when you write a book like this, you have to open up your life. You have to be willing to do so to a certain degree. And Patty was very gracious to the extent that she allowed me to write the book. You know, a lot of it is pretty personal. And I felt that it was connected to some of the music I'd written, and so that was just an important thing to write about.
So many of your songs, particularly the early ones, are about, you know, like searching for a dream and wanting to like bust out of the confines of your life. And in some ways, you know, I get the impression from your book that that was your father's story, except he never found the dream. It's kind of like a little bit like the story that you describe in your song, The River.
Right. You know, my dad was young. We went to work. But he'd been to war. He'd seen some of the world. It wasn't like he was going to be an extensive traveler or something. It didn't seem to be in the nature of his parents or many of the folks in my family. Really, we had a cousin that went off to Brown University. It was like a nuclear explosion took place. You know, it was just incredible for everybody. So you're correct. That my parents did really sort of live out a big part of that story. And to a certain degree, he did find his little piece of what he was looking for in California.
Because when you were 19, he moved to California.
Yeah, they moved out west. Which was a huge undertaking because it was like moving to another planet for them. But I think that's what my father wanted to do. He wanted to move to another planet. And they had very little. They had $3,000, and I think they had an old Rambler, and they slept 2 nights in the car and a night in a motel, and they had my little sister with them with all their stuff packed on top. It was a really go for broke decision, and it did pay off for them. You know, I think they enjoyed the West Coast and their California life quite a bit. You know, my father still had periods of illness that were
mental illness.
Yeah, difficult to manage, but I believe he did feel like he found something there that he couldn't have found at home.
Do you think the song "Born to Run" is in part about him and in part about you?
Well, someone mentioned that to me the other day. I always thought it was just about me. But what do you know? And looking back on it, my parents lived out quite a bit of that story themselves.
Except you had a dream in a way that your father maybe didn't have a dream that he could articulate.
It certainly wasn't one he could articulate. It was just, I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
And
this story, I think, is really interesting. You tell a story how in 1967, there's a lot of friction between you and your father. And you're in your teens, you're growing your hair long, you're into music, and long hair then, probably particularly in the working class town where you were, was a pretty...
It was unusual.
And a radical thing.
It was an unusual thing.
Making a statement.
You were making a statement.
So you're in a motorcycle accident, got thrown like 20 feet, like really hurt yourself pretty bad. You were in the hospital. You get home. Your father calls in a barber, and the barber cuts your hair against your will.
Oh, it's funny now. I didn't think it was funny then.
I'll bet you didn't.
But I was lucky. I was lucky I survived the motorcycle accident because the bike went under the car. I flew out about 20 or 25 feet. I didn't have the helmet on. I hit my head on the pavement, knocked myself out, gave myself a brain concussion. Screwed up my left leg, and I was lucky then that I didn't get killed because I didn't have any protective clothing on whatsoever, and I took a pretty good beating. But yes, such was the nature of the day when the barber was called in and the Samson's locks were trimmed.
But I actually found it an upsetting story because here, like, you barely survived. You're laying there disabled, and your father takes advantage of you and cuts off something that you love that's part of your identity when you're already so physically wounded. It felt very unfair to me. How did it feel to you at the time?
Such was the lay of the land at the time. I mean, of course, I was furious about it at the time. But what can you say? It's water under the bridge.
So you write, too, about your father that he was kind of very, let me quote you because you put it so well. You write that he loved me, but he couldn't stand me. He felt we competed for my mother's affections. We did. He also saw in me too much of his real self. Inside, beyond his rage, he harbored a gentleness, timidity, shyness, and a dreamy insecurity. These were things I wore on the outside, and the reflection of these qualities in his boy repelled him. I was soft, and he hated soft. Of course, he'd been brought up soft, a mama's boy, just like me. So that timidity and shyness that you wore on the outside, it's kind of like the opposite of your stage persona.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's bizarre.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the timidity and shyness of your youth?
T. Byrne Burnett once said that much of rock music is simply someone going, "Wow, daddy." So I've got to take some blame for that myself, I guess. But it was when I was young, you know, I was very shy and that was my personality. You know, I was a pretty sensitive kid and quite neurotic, filled with a lot of anxiety, which all would have been very familiar to my pop, you know, except it was a part of himself he was trying to reject. So I got caught in the middle of it, I think.
Do you know, like you say in the book, that you used to, you were so nervous for a while during your childhood that you blinked like 100 times a minute.
Yeah.
And you chewed your knuckles. Was there a specific cause of that anxiety, or is it just, do you think, the way
never
you were wired?
I mean, I never found out, you know. It was just tremendous anxiety, you know, tremendous feeling of being out of control of your young life.
So do you think that your stage persona draws both from, like, the angry and uninhibited side of you and the more inhibited, timid side of you?
I think it's both there. I think if you just, you know, I think I've had plenty of folks, if you just looked at the outside, it can read, you know, it's pretty alpha male, you know, which is a little ironic because, you know, that was personally never exactly really me. I think I created my particular stage persona out of my dad's life, and perhaps I even built it to suit him to some degree. When I was looking for a voice to mix with my voice, I put on my father's work clothes, as I say in the book, and I went to work. Whether it was a result of wanting to emulate him so I felt closer, or whether it was I wanted to be the reasonable voice of revenge for what I'd seen his life come to. It was all of these things, and it was an unusual creation. But most people's stage personas are created out of the flotsam and jetsam of their internal geography, and they're trying to create something that solves a series of very complex problems inside of them or in their history. And I think when I went to do that, that's what I was trying to integrate all of these very difficult things that I'd been unable to integrate in my life and in my life with my parents.
So you also lived near the church.
And oh, yeah.
Church was a part of your life, and you write about Catholicism. This is the world where I found the beginnings of my song. In Catholicism, there existed the poetry, danger, and darkness that reflected my imagination and my inner self. I found a language of great and harsh beauty, of fantastic stories, of unimaginable punishment, an infinite reward. Are there particular, like, Bible stories or, like, religious paintings that really made an impression on you?
No, it was more just the basics. I think when you're a child, you just cling to the basics, which is the basic story of Jesus and the crucifixion and hell and eternal punishment and the flames. This was all stuff that was, forget when you're young, this is very tangible and is as real as the gas station next door to you,
Maybe especially since the church was just about next door to you.
Exactly. So these things, and also because we lived in the presence of the church and the convent and the rectory and the school 24/7, this was an enormous cornerstone in the lives of my entire family. They were all pretty serious Catholic churchgoers. And as a child, these things were very, very terrifying. And
what things? Were you afraid of hell?
Yeah.
Of eternal damnation?
that one too. these were stories that were not stories. They were simply facts. This is what occurred. This is what can occur, unless you toe the line, my friend, So when you're a child, it was very, and you forget that the Catholic religion at the time was much darker and more mysterious. The entire Mass was in Latin. The church was, if you go to my church now, it's incredibly bright inside. But when I was young, it was very dark inside, it was just the difference in the way that they've painted it since I've gone there, and it strives for a very different and welcoming spirit. Where when I was young, it was sort of built to intimidate, even on this very local level, and this very small church in this small town. It still held that sort of held you in the palm of its darkness, and. It was something I carried with me, never forgot, brought into my music, and it's been in my music ever since.
So when your father told the family that he had to leave New Jersey and go to California, and he was going to do it, he hoped the family came with him, but he was going to go one way or another.
Yeah.
And so he left, your mother went with him, your youngest sister went with him, your sister who was in the middle was 17, she'd just gotten pregnant. You say she didn't even know how to make toast, and your parents left.
I may be a little harsh on her there. I think she knew how to make toast.
And you were 19, and suddenly, suddenly there were no authority figures in your life. I mean, your parents were gone. Your father wasn't going to,
right.
Whatever he was doing, he wasn't going to do it anymore. He wasn't going to be around. What did that freedom feel like to you?
Well, by the time I was 19, my parents weren't very authoritative over my life.
You were already gone?
Yeah. At the time, I was already down at the shore, and mm-hmm. I was staying out overnight and sleeping on the beach and, coming home at 3, 4 a.m. after having played a show or in some club. I was 5 years into my own life already. It started when I was 14 and a half. And I didn't have any doubt about that at that time about what I was going to do or where I was going. I was a musician. I was going to play. I had a band. We were going to make enough money to survive on. I was quite prepared for that to occur, whereas my sister was in a very different situation. She just had a newborn and a new marriage and really missed the family when they left.
During your early years as a musician, you were in Asbury Park, Boardwalk, Carnival atmosphere. What did you love about that kind of urban beach,
Yeah.
And the, Madame Marie and all of the boardwalk regulars. You made great stories out of those characters, mm-hmm. great songs out of those characters. But what appealed to you about knowing them and writing about them?
It was just my location at the time. I didn't move to Asbury with the thought of, you know, it wasn't an anthropological
but you connected in some
reason,
way.
But I went and I just fit in there. Asbury was down on its luck, but not as bad as it would get. And so there was a lot of room to move. You know, clubs were open till 5 a.m. There were gay clubs. And even in the late 60s, it was a bit of an open city. So as young ne'er-do-wells, we fit very, you know, we fit very comfortably in that picture. And then when I went to write, I just wrote about what was around me. It fired my imagination. It was, of course, was a colorful locale. The city was filled with characters and plenty of people at loose ends. And so it just became a very natural thing to write about. I didn't give it too much thought at the time, but I did think that it gave me a very individual identity, and that if I was going to go out into the musical world on a national level, I was very interested in being connected to my home state. There wasn't anyone else writing in this way about these things at that time. So it was something I did very intentionally, in a sense, as creating a certain very, very specific and original identity.
And that's one of the things that really interests me in comparing you to Dylan. Because when you first started, people were comparing you to Dylan, one of the new Dylans and
sure.
everything. In some ways, like, persona-wise, you're the opposite. He changed his name. He surrounded himself in mystery. His lyrics are very obscure. Your lyrics tell stories. You're all about a place. You reveal so much about yourself and the world around you in your songs. That, you know what I mean? Like, I know,
yeah.
I know that you're more than what you literally tell us about in the songs, but still, you have an identity and try to tell us something of who you are in your songs.
You just go where your psychology leads you. I think, you know, I've always loved the fact that Bob's been able to sustain his mystery over 50 or mm-hmm. 60 years. That's, in this day and age, that's quite a feat in itself. And, you know, the things that I loved about Bob's music, and I describe him in the book as the father of my country, which he really is, were things that just didn't fit when I went to do my job. You know, I'd come out of a somewhat different circumstance, and the clothes just didn't fit.
I want to quote you again. So you write, this is toward the beginning of your career, "I wanted to be a voice that reflected experience and the world I live in. So I knew in 1972 that to do this, I would need to write very well and more individually than I had ever written before." And this was, at some point you realized too that although you had like the most popular bar band in Asbury Park, mm-hmm. that there was a bigger world, there was a lot of talented
yeah.
people. And in order to like be someone in that world, to have a career, to make a difference, that you had to figure out what was unique about you and you had to write great songs. And in fact, you achieved that. You wrote great songs, but you know, how did you go about trying to write the best songs that you could? I mean, when you knew that a lot of this was going to depend on the songwriting.
When I thought about signing a record deal or writing something that might put me in the position, because I'd already had plenty of things that had fallen through with my rock bands, I looked at myself and I just said, well, you know, I can sing, but I'm not the greatest singer in the world. I can play the guitar very well, but I'm not the greatest guitar player in the world. What excites me about a lot of the artists I love? And I realized, well, they created their own personal world that I could enter into through their music and through their songwriting. There's people that can do it instrumentally, like Jimi Hendrix or Edge of U2 or Pete Townsend. I didn't have as unique a purely musical signature. I was a creature of a lot of different influences. And so I said, well, if I'm going to
project an individuality. It's going to have to be in my writing. And at the time, for one of the few times in my life, I didn't have a band. I just had myself and the guitar. So I was going to have to do something with just my voice, just the guitar, and just my songs that was going to move someone enough to give me a shot. So I wrote songs that were very lyrically alive and lyrically dense, and they were unique, but it really came out of a motivation to, where I understood it was I was going to have to make my mark that way.
You've lived your life, a lot of your life on the road, and for a lot of your early years, I mean, you were single, you were in monogamous or semi-monogamous relationships, as you'd describe it, but you weren't married, you didn't have children. You had a first marriage, and then Patti Sciolfa joined the band, and you got married, and you have three children now.
Yes.
What did it take for you to see family as something that was a wonderful thing as opposed to something that was going to harm your sense of freedom and flexibility and creativity?
I think for a lot of musicians, that's a difficult call because by nature, we're transient. We move on. We're people that, like I say in the book, there's folks that stay and there's folks that go, and we're folks that go. I didn't have a blueprint from my childhood that I could call on, which is an enormous deficit when you're trying to put together a family life. I didn't see a family life where men were thriving inside of it. You know, my dad tended to blame family for his inability to achieve what he wanted to achieve, you know. So, unfortunately, I was coming from that particular frame of mind, and it took quite a bit of work and time and mistakes to begin to feel, to understand the strength and that comes along with building a home life, you know. That was very mysterious to me. I was very skeptical of it for a long time and didn't understand it fully until Patti and I got together.
Was it helpful to be married to somebody who was in the band? Because she would certainly understand what life on the road was and what being a musician is, because she is one.
Yeah, I think so. Patti was an artist and a musician, and she was a songwriter. And she was a lot like me in that she was transient also. She worked busking on the streets in New York. She waitressed. She just lived a life. She lived a musician's life. She lived an artist's life. So we were both people who were very uncomfortable in a domestic setting, getting together and trying to build one and seeing if our particularly strange jigsaw puzzle pieces were going to fit together in a way that was going to create something different for the two of us, and it did.
You write about redefining what it meant to you to be a man, that you'd learned about the rigidity and the blue-collar narcissism of manhood, 50 style, from your father, and you learned to always withhold something. You do not lower your mask. Did you consciously rethink what it meant to be a man?
These are hard questions. Fresh air is difficult. Let me think. Well, you know, you're young and you're always in pursuit of your young manhood. You know, you're trying to figure out what does that mean. What is, you know, there's a lot of pressure on young men to sort that out, and you know, we tend to gravitate towards one-dimensional iconography as far as what it means to be a fully grown man, and you can get lost in so much of it out there. But you know, part of my on-stage creation was someone trying to sort that out. I think initially our audiences were filled with young men. You know, our initial audience was a lot of young guys who I think were trying to, who you played a bit of a big brother role for, and we're trying to sort out a lot of the same things right as soon as Born to Run hit, you know. So it was something that I worked pretty hard on.
You started going to therapy in 1983. And at some point, you say in your 60s, you had a really bad depression. And I'm wondering if you thought about, during that period when you were very depressed, how many people in the world really wanted to be you. And
doesn't count for that much at the time.
Yeah, right.
You know, but of course, you know, people see you on stage and, yeah, I'd want to be that guy. I want to be that guy myself very often. You know, I get I have plenty of days where I go, man, I wish I could be that guy. And, you know, it's not quite. There's a big difference between what you see on stage and then my general daily, my daily existence.
I'm sorry?
No, I'm talking to myself.
Oh, okay.
Don't let that bother you. It's part of my illness. I do it all the time.
You're right about how being on stage is almost like medicine for you. You know,
sure.
Does it get you out of yourself? Does it?
Oh, of course. You're immediately pulled out of the inside of your head, and it immediately changes your frame of mind. I've never been on stage where I've. No, that's not true. I have been on stage on a few occasions where I felt I couldn't escape the interior of my interior thoughts, but. Peter Wolf once said, what's the strangest thing you can do on stage? Think about what you're doing. There's just nothing weirder you can do. If you're up there thinking about what you're doing, you're just not there. And it's not going to happen. You know. So trying to learn how to overcome those, which is a normal thing to do. You're in front of a lot of people. People are going to get very self-conscious. So you have to learn to sort of overcome that tendency towards self-consciousness and just blow it wide open and you jump in and join all those people that are out there enjoying what you're doing together.
During the Depression, there was a period of a year and a half when you weren't on the road. You were home with one of your sons, I guess with your youngest.
Mm-hmm.
Did that contribute to the depression because you couldn't be on stage and you couldn't have that kind of cathartic experience?
Yeah, I tend to be not my own best company. I can get a little lost if I don't have my work to occasionally focus me. But at the same time, you've got to be able to figure that out. The year and a half I was home, my son was in his last year of high school, and it was kind of my last opportunity to be here with him in the house, and I wanted to get that right.
So I want to ask you about a physical thing that happened to you, that you write about in the book. You were getting numbness and tingling.
Oh, right.
And was it your left hand?
My left hand and arm, yeah.
Yeah, and it was hard for you to play. And it turned out you had a disc problem in your neck.
Right.
And you had this, incredible surgery where they make an incision in your throat.
Yeah.
Push the vocal cords aside and basically rebuild your discs.
Correct. It was probably from thrashing my head around for 40 years or so. You know, it was just wear and tear. And I had a pinched nerve, and it was causing a lot of electricity down my arm. And I ignored it for about 4 or 5 years. It was just kind of getting worse and getting worse, but I was still able to get around on the guitar. And then it was the middle of the Wrecking Ball tour. It simply became too much. I was having a lot of pain in my neck after the show, and my arm was going numb, and my fingers were going numb, and towards the end of the night, it could have got difficult to play. So I said, well, I guess I have to do something about it. So I found a doctor, and it's kind of an everyday operation, though you wouldn't want to get it wrong. You know, you can lose your voice or
lose
the complete feeling in your arms.
Putting your vocal cords aside?
That was the part that was a little anxiety creating. I said, well, what happens? He says, well, you know, we kind of slit your throat a little bit. Then we go in and we pull your vocal cords and we tie them off to one side. And then I get in there with the screwdriver and the little tools and some titanium. And then we make a little basket in there. Then we take some bone off your hip and we stuff that into the basket. And we kind of sew you back up, and before long that all grows together and you're as good as new. Amazingly, that is exactly what happened. You know, I spent about 3 months where I couldn't sing at all, So that was anxiety provoking. But after that, I went back out. I sang for 2 hours in my garage one day to see if I had a voice. It seemed to be okay. And we went to South Africa, and we just started playing and did the rest of the tour, and it was much improved. So it's remained much improved to this day.
Did physical pain, was that part of the cause of the depression? Did it feed depression?
Physical pain?
Yeah.
Physical pain is my friend. I pursue it every night for 4 hours. That makes me feel good. I'm a good Catholic boy. So, no, I don't think so. No, it didn't have anything to do with it.
Okay. Do you feel like there's an extrovert and an introvert within you that sometimes compete?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose everyone has that. And in me, it's just a lot more noticeable. The extremes are a lot greater. I mean, if you see me performing, you're going, that guy's simply the most extroverted guy I've ever seen. What a show off, you know? But if you've seen me very often on a daily basis, and all the while growing up, I was very, very introverted, very introverted. So I have sort of the extremes of both of those characteristics.
As you mentioned in your book, you wanted to write songs that you wouldn't outgrow, that you could sing as an adult,
right,
that weren't just kids' songs and,
yeah,
you know, done, accomplished.
Yeah.
But when you sing some of your early songs now, as you still do, like Born to Run, does the song have a different meaning to you than it did when you first started, performing it?
We just had a series of concerts where the show was very interesting because we'd start out with my earliest material and we played about half a record off of our first record and then half or three quarters off of the second record. So it was going back to my earliest music and re-singing my earliest songs that I wrote when I was 22. And it was funny that they just fit perfectly well. You know, there was they sort of gather the years up as time passes, and you can revisit. The wonderful thing about my job is you can revisit your 22-year-old self or your 24-year-old self any particular night you want. The songs pick up some extra resonance, I hope, but they're there, and I can revisit that period of my life when I choose. So it's quite a nice experience. And the songs themselves do broaden out as time passes and take on subtly different meanings, take on a little more meaning, I find.
What's an example of a song that's taken on a different meaning or more meaning for you?
A lot of the ones that are people's favorites, you know, Born to Run, that expands every time we go out. It just seems to, the more of your life fills in the story. And when we hit it every night, it's always a huge catharsis. It's fascinating to see the audience singing it back to me. It's quite wonderful, you know, to see people that intensely singing your song.
As someone who grew up in Brooklyn and now lives in Philadelphia, I love that you've continued to live in New Jersey, not only in New Jersey, but not far from where you grew up. Why have you stayed close to the home that your father left? Your father went to the opposite coast when you were a teenager.
It's rather ironic, but I just felt very comfortable here, and I was uncomfortable with city life. I was more or less a kid that came out of a small town, and I was a beach bum and loved the ocean and loved the sun, and I liked the people that were here. I liked who I was when I was here. I wanted to continue writing about the things that I felt were important, and those things were pretty much here. I felt like a lot of my heroes from the past lost themselves in different ways once they had a certain amount of success. And I was nervous about that, and I wanted to remain grounded. And living in this part of New Jersey was something that was essential to who I was and continues to this day to be that way.
So we've been recording this interview in your home studio. Would you just tell us a little bit about the studio? I mean, it was built for you.
Well, Patty built this studio. She really She, with some help, this was just a part of our garage. And
yes, because I'm looking through a curtain. Well, the curtain's closed now, but when it was open, there was like a big vintage.
Yeah, there's a lot of
car
motorcycles.
Or truck
over
or motorcycles.
There.
And, yeah.
There's a lot of.
Most studios don't have a garage attached to it like that.
We're surrounded by vintage automobiles and okay. motorcycles. But this piece of the garage, Patty said, well, let's make a studio out of it, because we were using the house across the street to record in for a long time. And I said, okay, you know, go ahead, see what it's about. And she just did an incredible job building this facility here. But it's like, if I died when I was 15, went to heaven, this is where I think I would have ended up. We're surrounded by guitars, keyboards, recording decks. It's just paradise.
Bruce Springsteen, I can't thank you enough for inviting us into your studio and allowing us to do this interview.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Very enjoyable. I appreciate it.
And I really love the book.
Thanks a lot.
Bruce Springsteen's new memoir is called Born to Run. The companion CD of songs spanning his career is called Chapter and Verse. Our interview was recorded last Friday at his home recording studio in New Jersey. Our thanks to Carrie Goldstein and Marilyn Laverty for helping to make it happen, and to Eric Matheny, who helped us once we got there. Our interview was produced by Sam Brigger with Teresa Madden. It was recorded by our technical director and engineer, Audrey Bentham. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, I'll talk with Brian Christie about his National Geographic investigation into the illegal trade of rhinoceros horn. And Sam will talk with Bob Weir, who is a founding member of the Grateful Dead and has a new album. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.